Hey, I'm Jane Lindholm. I'm the host of Vermont Edition, and I'm just popping in to tell you that this podcast has been edited for brevity. Thanks for listening.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Mitch Wertlieb in for Jane Lindholm. Here first are the numbers. Last year in Vermont, 20 homicides and 124 suicides were recorded. Of the 20 homicides, 6 were related to incidents of domestic violence. That accounts for 30% of homicides in the state, and the victims ranged in age from 20 to 93 years old. From a longer sample of data, 49%, nearly half, of all adult homicides in Vermont between 1994 and 2016 were attributed to domestic violence. But as sobering as those statistics are, they don't begin to relate the fear, anxiety, and trauma that domestic violence generates. It can destroy families, disrupt communities, and create a ripple effect of violent behavior that's often passed on to future generations of men, women, and children. The age-old question is what to do about stopping it. There is no easy answer to that. But today we have some in-studio guests who will try and help us get a better understanding of the issue. We're going to begin by speaking with 7 Days reporter Mark Davis. And Mark, thank you very much for being with us here today.
Hey, thanks for having me.
You wrote an article recently about a murder-suicide in Maidstone that police say was a result of domestic violence. I should warn listeners that the details here are incredibly disturbing. Who were the victims here and what happened?
The victim was a 27-year-old woman named Molly McLean, who lived in Essex County in Maidstone for a long time with her husband, Jason McLean. They had a long, sad history of domestic violence, a lot of familiar, sad events that we see all too often that culminated this summer in July. Jason brutally murdered her in their home and then killed himself. Their two young children, ages 2 and 4, were in the home and apparently witnessed at least some of it.
How old were Jason and Molly?
Molly McLean was 27 years old. Jason was a little bit older than that. They had been together for several years. Essentially, they were the sort of first significant relationship for each other.
You mentioned that this couple had two small children, which makes the story even more tragic. Did they witness this horrible event? Where are they now?
They were at least in the home and saw some of that, and they are now living with Molly's mother in Pittsburgh, New Hampshire. There's sort of a DCF custody case that's still pending, but they were found in blood-soaked clothes after this happened.
Molly did take some legal steps, as you reported in your article, to keep Jason away from her when his violent behavior showed no signs of abating. What did she do? Why did it ultimately not do enough to save her life?
I think one of the most haunting things about this story is that people look at this and say at the end of the day, Molly did just about everything she could do, everything that she was encouraged to do. She called the police. She reached out to authorities. She got a restraining order against him. She was making plans to leave permanently. She was someone who was a stay-at-home mom and started looking into a possible career, a way to support herself. She began reaching out to friends again, telling family about this, sort of ending this period of isolation that she had been in. And in her last weeks was in court, was speaking with police, in constant contact with the local sheriff. Again, you look at this and people say Molly did everything she possibly could have, and obviously this still happens.
What was the pattern of behavior leading up to this ultimately, you know, deadly event?
A sort of sadly cliched pattern of abuse of Jason allegedly, you know, hitting her, followed by periods of calm. She had actually left him for a long period of time. She moved out of the home, moved to Littleton, New Hampshire, but after a while decided that she wanted to give it another chance, wanted her family to be back together again and move back into the home. She at one point filed for divorce that was proceeding, then she abandoned that. And so there was this sort of fits and starts attempt to break away, which again is very common. And towards the end, it seemed as if she was making a very determined effort to leave him permanently.
Was there any history of drugs or alcohol involved?
Molly's family says that Jason often struggled with drinking and abusing pills. There's not a lot in the public record or criminal file about that. But they certainly say he was someone who indulged in both of those things, and they think that sort of helped fuel some of the horrible things he ended up doing.
This brings up another difficult problem because, as you said, Molly really did everything that she was supposed to do here. She reached out to authorities. She had friends, a support network, family who were trying to get her out of this situation. It seems that ultimately when Jason killed her, then killed himself, he, as I understand it, was brought up on charges at this point, and that sort of pushed him over the edge. Is that an accurate reading?
I think most people look at this in hindsight and say that probably contributed. Yeah, he was facing criminal charges as well as the civil restraining order procedure against him. I spoke with the prosecutor in this case, among other people, who in hindsight can't help wondering if filing the charge and pursuing the charge, which is obviously the right thing to do, didn't sort of inadvertently fuel him or perhaps make him even more despondent and desperate towards the end.
I mean, I really don't want to send the wrong message here. Molly did everything she was supposed to do, and yet
yes. –
This has to be a concern for law enforcement officials, prosecutors, people like that. You have to straddle this incredibly delicate line between getting someone the protection they need but not making sure that the person who's doing the abusing is going to be pushed to that ultimate result.
Right. And I think it's important to note that there are certainly plenty of cases in which someone gets a restraining order, takes steps to speak with law enforcement, and it goes well, right? Like mm-hmm. We don't hear about those cases for obvious reasons. And so I think it's really important that we keep that in mind. But yeah, people look at this and they're incredibly frustrated. It's haunting to think that someone did everything they were supposed to do. The officials surrounding it seemed to say that everyone around her in the end was doing what they were supposed to do. And still this happens. But of course, she's not the only one. We see this a handful of times every year for as long as we can remember.
Mark, do we know anything about Jason's own background, whether he experienced any domestic violence in his own life, perhaps when he was a child?
I wasn't able to get too far into Jason. His father is deceased. His mother apparently wasn't around very much. People who know him describe him as someone who sort of lived almost all of his life in the Northeast Kingdom, worked as a janitor for a time, was unemployed towards the end of his life as well. He's a bit of a mystery, and I think it's also important to note he had no criminal record before these recent events, so he was not someone on law enforcement radar before this summer.
This is about as terrible an event as anyone could imagine, yet from the officials that you've spoken to and as you just alluded to before, this is not unusual as related to domestic violence, is it?
The statistic that half of all homicides in Vermont end up being related to domestic violence in the past two decades is one, frankly, I've covered criminal justice for a little while. I'm embarrassed to say I was unfamiliar with that notion. And I think it's a really alarming one, right? This is something that's been a point of emphasis in a lot of different people, and yet we see this very persistent rate. The solutions, I think, are quite elusive.
And the way the pattern that this happened, as you say, Molly left for a while, came back, tried to make things work. That also is a pattern that we see often in these cases.
There are experts who would tell you it can take as many as 7 or 8 times for someone to leave their abusive partner before they finally leave for good. And there's some very valid reasons for that in a lot of cases. Economic dependence certainly plays a role, a desire to have a family and not have to leave and raise your kids on your own. Maidstone's obviously a fairly isolated place, and so I think geographic isolation also plays a role here, and we see that often in rural Vermont. So yeah, a lot of the very similar fact patterns that we see again and again and again were certainly at play here.
What do state officials say about ways to reduce these incidents or, in a best-case scenario, eliminate them completely?
I don't think anyone's got a good idea for how we eliminate this completely. And I think one of the sadder parts of this story was, usually you want to say, okay, here's the problem and here's the solution. And even people who know this really well aren't standing up and saying, I have the solution. I think certainly areas that people want to look at would include, obviously, are there ways to incarcerate allegedly abusive people? But that's a fraught conversation. He's certainly innocent until proven guilty, and you can't put people in prison forever. Eventually, they would come out even if you tried some sort of crackdown. I think the widespread availability of firearms is a common denominator again and again. Jason was forbidden from having a firearm, and in fact, law enforcement authorities confiscated the rifle he kept with him. Apparently, he had no problem getting a hold of another weapon, though. So that comes up a lot. And then I think you want to talk about counseling and support services for both victims and abusers. That was an interesting thing that came up in my conversations, people bringing up. Of course, we want to help the victims, but perhaps we should also be looking to help these abusers in some way. And I think that's a tough conversation to have, and no one's got the perfect solution there either. But that's something that really doesn't get discussed very often.
What about funding? Is there enough state funding to go around to deal with all these issues you're talking about?
The next time I talk to someone who says they don't want more funding for their area of concern is going to be the first time. I did not hear a lot of concern about money. I think it was more of a strategy concern, if you will. I'm sure we could always use more money for things, but there's a lot of grants out there that the state has been availing itself of for years. There's a lot of officials who look at this full time. And so, again, I think the concern is almost a tactical one as much as a financial one at this point.
There's an awareness concern here, too. Writing that story and the details, and I urge everyone to read it in 7 days, very difficult. It must have been difficult for you to report it. Are you hoping at least, though, that people that read that may – it may spark something in someone and say, I know something like this could be happening. I'm in a situation like this myself. I don't want it to end this way.
We wrote it because at the end of the day, we were saying, yep, this is the same pattern over and over again. And I think there becomes this quiet acceptance of it. And I think we're all guilty of it sometimes, myself included. And so we thought, okay, let's try to highlight one of these. And again, the killing, the murder was an incredibly graphic and shocking event. But the events leading up to it were not shocking at all. We're a familiar and almost cliche, as sad as that sounds. And so I think it is worth highlighting one. Perhaps we can learn from it. But again, I don't see any easy solution to take away.
Mark Davis is a reporter whose article, Till Death Do Us Part, Maidstone's Grisly Murder-Suicide Was Domestic Violence, is in 7 days. I want to thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thanks for having me.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Mitch Wertlieb in for Jane Lindholm, and we're talking about domestic violence today and some of the ultimate consequences that it can have. Joining me now in our VPR studios is Auburn Watersong, Associate Director of the Public Policy for the Vermont Network Against Domestic and Sexual Violence. Auburn, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Mitch.
And also in the studio is Captain J.P. Sinclair, Chief Criminal Investigator at the Vermont State Police Bureau of Criminal Investigations. He's also a member of the state's Domestic Violence Fatality Review Commission, which was created by former Governor Howard Dean in 2002. Welcome. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
You heard this horrific story about what happened in Maidstone that Mark Davis was just telling us about. There was just this month a murder in Burlington in which a man allegedly killed his wife with a cleaver related to domestic violence. Captain Sinclair, let me start with you. Are law enforcement officials in Vermont adequately equipped to deal with this problem? If not, what do they need that they currently don't have?
No, I think over the years we've emphasized a lot of our training through the police academy to focus on issues surrounding domestic violence. And over the years, the legislature has given us more tools through the criminal justice statutes, especially surrounding the statute with domestic violence. We've expanded the definitions under household members. We have upgraded to felony level inside the statute for certain offenses of domestic violence. So it's the tools are there, but as Mark said, it's a very complex issue.
How have the laws in Vermont on domestic abuse changed over the years?
Well, as I've been with the state police for about 27 years, and as a young trooper, we had just barely gotten the actual statute for domestic violence, a separate statute. And again, over the years, we've watched it expand. The initial definitions of household members have expanded to cover more victims of domestic violence, and we've the TRO system, the restraining order system, the expansion to civil orders to deal with issues like stalking or harassment. So there's been an expansion of the tools available to us, but it does still remain a problem.
Auburn Watersong, you're with the Vermont Network Against Domestic and Sexual Violence. What does your organization do for people who may be looking to escape a potentially life-threatening situation?
Well, I work at the network, which is the statewide coalition of 15 different member programs. Those programs serve domestic and sexual violence victims around the state and include stalking and dating violence as well. Those programs do all sorts of advocacy. It's court advocacy, but it's also navigating economic systems, benefit programs. It's helping victims' children with trauma issues they might have if they've witnessed violence. It's working with school systems and other community partners. So there's a lot being done out there.
One of the things that Mark talked about was the challenges to rural parts of the state, like Vermont, where there's more geographic isolation, perhaps less of a support network for victims to turn to. Is that something that you find to be a real challenge with the people that come seeking help?
You know, and I've been in this work for over 20 years and worked myself up in the Northeast Kingdom. And I know that isolation is a large factor, and it's rural isolation, and it's also isolation that is chosen often and directed by the perpetrator, you know, isolating the victim from the family, isolating the victim even geographically where they will move to more isolated locations. So yes, we have seen that as an issue, and we do know the need for resources in those areas just because of this.
Captain Sinclair, I want to talk about the responsibilities that the rest of us have. If this is a problem that is, you're lucky enough not to have touched your life, you may think, oh, well, it's not anything to do with me. But what responsibility do neighbors, friends, family have when it comes to intervening if they suspect the worst is happening?
Well, we certainly ask people to be vigilant of certainly within their own families and circle of people that they know for issues surrounding domestic violence and supporting people that are in the throes of this, even if it's if you're living in an apartment and you hear something going on, you know, some shouting, it's something that's not right. The adage out there now of see something, say something. I mean, have the courage to stand up and make that call to 911. And we will always send people out to sort it out. And that's the intervening event that can keep something from escalating.
Now, I do want to follow up on that, though, because I'm picturing that scenario you just mentioned. You know, couples sometimes get into loud arguments, you know?
Absolutely.
They fight about all sorts of things. And certainly the police don't want to be bothered with a call to 911 that is just a loud argument. So, again, it's a very difficult line there. How do you tell the difference?
Well, from the law enforcement side, that's a very routine call. I mean, we get...
Really?
Disturbances of the peace. These are what we are in society for, is to deal with situations like this. And if we show up and it's nothing more than that this was a loud argument or it was two neighbors arguing, we'll sort that out. But if it's the beginnings of or a continuation of a domestic violence situation, that's our chance to intervene.
So err on the side of caution.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Auburn Watersong, I want to put that same thing to you because I think this is something you must see a lot. You must get women or men. I mean, this is not a problem that's just for women. This is for anybody who's being abused in a domestic situation. What about that? What advice do you have for people who say, you know what, I've been hearing some bad stuff going on next door, but I don't want to get involved. I don't want to be pushy. What do you say in those situations?
Mm-hmm. Well, certainly when there's an emergency situation, of course, call 911,
right,
even if you don't hear anything that sounds physical. If you're just concerned, trust your gut and call. The other thing that I would say is I think it's really important for community members and neighborhoods to get involved in domestic violence prevention work. It's what we really need, in addition to whatever tweaks we can make in the criminal justice system, is we really need some concerted community efforts around shifting the culture of violence. And what that means is we need these neighbors and friends who are concerned about the people in their buildings or the people on their blocks to reach out to our member programs, for example, and say, I'm really concerned about this. What can I do in my community? And there's plenty that they could be asked to do. And I think it's really important to be a part of that active conversation and make sure that it's known throughout their neighborhoods that violence won't be tolerated, and that's where they're coming from is a safe community is what they want to build. And I think that takes some commitment and action, and it takes it from all identities, not just women helping victims, but we need men, we need all across the gender spectrum, all across the racial spectrum, everybody coming together to make some real cultural shifts here.
This sounds like an education component you're talking about, not necessarily directly related to schools, but a community education effort.
Absolutely, absolutely. And our member programs are doing that as much as they can, and they can always use interested folks who want to help shift that culture.
Captain Sinclair, you heard Mark Davis talk about the sticky issue of guns when these things come up. Judges can seize weapons with court orders. Would that, in your view, be enough of a preventative measure? Does it matter if someone is determined to commit violence against someone that they live with and know?
Yeah, and as Mark said, in this case, you know, the frustrating aspects are that the system that we have in place to secure his weapon, again, the accessibility is out there for other modes, other means of violence, and that's the hard part about these situations that Molly was in. She was in, you know, that very dangerous period when she's leaving her abuser, and when, as Mark and I talked last week, it's the only way to guarantee 100% that a victim's safe is physical removal of the accused, but that's not how our criminal justice system works. And obviously, the court system has to have balance of the prosecution and pursuit of a criminal case versus the individual liberties that we cherish in our society. So it's a difficult balance.
Auburn Watersong, let's talk a little bit about the economic component of this as well, something else that Mark Davis referred to. A lot of times you will hear people say, hey, I would never accept that. The second that I get hit by my loved one, I'm out of there. But mm-hmm. That's not so easy, especially when kids are involved, right?
Absolutely. And you brought up you mentioned the economic component, which is like the leading factor that we know. It's the leading factor why victims often choose to stay. You know, if they're choosing between homelessness and violence that in their home, they may choose a roof over their head for their children. And so those are the choices that victims are constantly making. We also know that economics sort of plays into a bit of this risk assessment around the perpetrator. So if, for example, a perpetrator is unemployed, that is an indicator that there might be a greater risk for lethality. We have some indicators in that way. So we know the stress on families with regard to economics plays a factor in the risk in domestic violence. And then we also know that economics may keep victims in those risky situations because they don't want to be impoverished when they leave. Mm. So
we're going to go to the phones now. We've got a call from Judy in St. George. Hi, Judy. Judy, you're there?
Yes, I'm here. Thank you.
Sure.
I really appreciate this show. Shows like it have helped all of us to see how widespread domestic violence is in all social classes, all economic classes. But I worked in immigration for many years, and I'm concerned that there's one group of people who are unable to access services as easily as the rest of us, even though the services are inadequate for all of us. But that's people whose first language is not English. And my question is, if there are efforts afoot, if there can be efforts made to create services that provide early intervention and culturally and linguistically appropriate services.
Mm-hmm. Judy, thank you for the call. Which of you would like to tackle that?
I can start with
sure.
A little bit of that.
Go ahead.
So our member programs that work with victims actually do have access to something called Language Line, which offers interpretation services if English isn't their first language. And we do try to make sure across the state that our services are acceptable in whatever language the victim presents with or is most comfortable with. You know, I think this caller points to a really interesting challenge for us in the movement around domestic violence. I think we have a growing edge here for us. Our movement was really founded back in the beginning, 20, 30 years ago, by sort of a white feminist movement. And we're starting to realize now that an anti-violence movement must include an ability to reach people of color and people of different ethnicities and races and different languages. And so for, you know, in the recent years, we've been focused on expanding that. And as Vermont changes, we're trying to keep up with that. Our diversity is growing in Vermont. And that's a challenge that we face. And we're always looking for more resources to help us do that.
Captain Sinclair, has this been a challenge for law enforcement as well, dealing with immigrant communities that may not have English as a first language and the communication gap that can sometimes result from that?
Yeah, Albert and I were actually speaking before we came in here, and one of the greatest challenges that we've had in law enforcement that, you know, we're really pushing an awareness of to our members is that not even so much a language. I mean, we can get interpreters. That's never a problem. But, you know, some of these folks come from obviously countries that have an intense distrust of the police for good reasons. And so now, you know, they find themselves in our country, in our communities, and they just don't have the natural trust that we would like them to. And that's incumbent upon us to continue to make that outreach to these communities to show them that we are here to serve them, we are here to protect them, we are here to offer them whatever services they need from the police. But it's, you know, we have an uphill struggle with that because we're trying to overcome sometimes lifetimes or generations of a very different situation from where they came from.
Mm-hmm. Matt is on the line now with us from Burlington. Hi, Matt. Matt,
yes. Yeah, can you hear me?
We can. Yep, go right ahead.
I am an experienced family court attorney. I've been representing both perpetrators and victims of domestic violence for about 35 years now in Vermont. I just wanted to make two brief comments. The first is that I'm very impressed so far that you folks have been using gender-neutral language. In my experience, there are both women and men that are the victims of domestic violence, so I think this should be pointed out. The second thing I wanted to mention is that I make it a point when I have folks in my office to ensure that they are telling the truth. Now, that may sound like I'm stating the obvious, but in my experience, there are folks from time to time who claim to be victims of violence but are not. And, of course, there are perpetrators who claim not to be perpetrators, but they are. So I think it's incumbent upon all of us, no matter what side we're on or whether we're purporting to support victims or perpetrators, to really try to get to the bottom of what the motivations are. For example, one motivation is that some people sometimes exaggerate when they are in the initial throes of filing for divorce. Again, I think this is uncommon, but I just wanted to make the point, and I will hang up and take the answer off the air.
Well, Matt, before you hang up, can I just briefly ask you, how, as a family court attorney, do you get to the bottom of the truth? Are there certain questions you ask to try to find out if someone's telling the truth?
There are. As I say, I've been doing this a long time. When I have folks in my office, I usually press them pretty darn hard, not in a disrespectful way, but there have been times that I've learned through pressing folks, watching their body language, watching the tone of their response. And I have had folks confess to me in my office that they have not told the truth in affidavits or they have exaggerated. Again, I want to emphasize this is not common, but it does happen from time to time.
Okay. Mark, Matt, thank you very much for the call. Auburn, I'd like you to respond to a couple of the things Matt said. One about the gender-neutral issue here. I do think that there is a sort of stereotype that this happens only to women, but your organization certainly does not discriminate when it comes to that. You're there for everyone.
Exactly. We are, and we do know what happens to both genders. That said, we also know that the history of domestic violence homicides in Vermont, while the gender of the victim is really, the record shows it's about 50-50, male or female, the responsible parties are about 81% male.
Mm-hmm.
And only 19% female. So, you know, just looking at the data, that's how it plays out in Vermont. But definitely we serve all genders, yeah, in our programs.
Captain Sinclair, following a little bit on what Matt was talking about, I imagine there's a different situation that police need to deal with, especially when they're coming upon a scene that's happening in real time. And this just happened in Burlington. The situation there could have been a lot worse than it ended up being.
Right.
It was terrible. A woman died. Another woman was severely injured. But the police were able to size up the situation, even though there were bystanders there with weapons drawn, as we understand it.
Yep.
Can you tell us a little bit about how police are trained to deal with these situations when they get a 911 call and they're going into something they've got no idea what they're going to be seeing?
This is by far one of the most frightening calls that law enforcement goes on. Obviously, there have been a number of police officers over the years that were shot or murdered in responding to domestic violence situations. Burlington PD did an amazing job. If you can imagine rolling into that with obviously some of the graphic descriptions of what was going on. Again, as you said, you had private citizens intervening, weapons drawn. You're in a dense neighborhood area. Certainly the possibility of a police shooting is very real in situations like that. But they were able to defuse that and get him into custody without anybody else getting hurt. And that's the best outcome you could hope for. But, these are very scary situations for police officers to go into. You're walking into a situation that is very dynamic, it's changing rapidly. You're walking into a home that you've never been into before, and you're dealing with somebody probably you've never dealt with before. So these are tough. They're very dynamic.
Auburn, I want to ask about something else that Mark Davis was telling us about, and this has to do with, you know, how do you handle a situation where the abuser obviously needs help, but it's the abuser, and this is somebody who's doing something terrible. Has your organization been looking at different ways to get to those people? Obviously, you want to help the victims. You want to give them a safe place and perhaps start them on a new life. But is there a way to get to how to get the abuser to stop doing what they are doing?
Mm-hmm. So right now in Vermont, we have a system of domestic violence accountability programming that happens in the community. Across the state, we have a number of community-based programs that are facilitated that look at sort of cognitive self-change, sort of how abusers can choose to change their behavior. I do have to say that these are sort of struggling programs right now. They're under-resourced, and that is something that the Domestic Violence Council has been working on for a few years now to get more resources for that programming. We also hear from victims that victims want that programming for offenders as well. And we're looking at other options besides criminal justice options that victims are saying would be appropriate for the offenders because, you know, in many cases, that's their partner, that's part of their family. Is incarceration the result that the victim even would prefer? So we're going into all of those conversations with our community partners on a state level and on local levels, and I think we do need more resources around what is available for offenders to make those changes.
Our time is growing short here, and I do want to try to end on a positive note here, Auburn, and back to you again on this because I want the message to get out there, if it's true, that people who are seeking help, there are success stories. You must seen them. You must have seen people get through
for
this.
For sure. These are the exceptions. And because they are so horrific and so, so tragic and sad, we hear about them and focus on them more. But we know that in Vermont, we have served so many folks that have successfully moved on toward, you know, safe and healthy relationships. So, yeah, for sure. We want people to reach out for help, knowing that they don't all end like this. Thankfully, we're so grateful for that. Our member programs served just last year 9,300 people. So 9,300 people were served of domestic or sexual violence victims in the state. So if you putting that in perspective, we know that there are people that are being helped and are able to get the services they need. And we should just say folks can reach any member program by going to our website at vtnetwork.org if they want to find out which program is in their area.
That's excellent. And we'll have links to that as well on our website at vpr.net. And Captain Sinclair, just to follow up on that a little bit, I really was encouraged by what you said earlier that, again, nobody wants to say make a frivolous call to the police, but err on the side of caution. Police are there to help. If you suspect something is happening, you guys don't mind getting that call if it turns out not to be a worst case scenario.
Not at all. That's our job.
That's your job. All right. I want to thank you both so much for being here. Arben Watersong is the Associate Director of Public Policy for the Vermont Network Against Domestic and Sexual Violence. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
And Captain J.P. Sinclair, Chief Criminal Investigator at the Vermont State Police Bureau of Criminal Investigation. Thank you so much.
Thank you.